White Rocket Entertainment.
White Rocket Entertainment, podcast number 355.
10, 9, 8, 7, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition, 2, 1, 0. We have a liftoff. We have a liftoff, and it's lighting up the areas. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear to the top.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment and by all of our patrons via Patreon.com. I'm Van Allen Plexico. On this episode, I'm presenting the Beowulf panel from DragonCon 2018 in the High Fantasy track. This was a great idea by the track director, Jennifer Lang, who suggested that we dig into various media interpretations of the original classic Beowulf story. So we dug into the 13th Warrior and the digitally animated version that Neil Gaiman wrote the script for a few years ago, among other versions of it. And we also had some good input from the audience at the panel. So without further ado, here is Jennifer and me talking about various media interpretations of Beowulf. Enjoy!
So this is Beowulf and Media Adaptions. I'm Jennifer Lang. I'm the track director for this track. And with me is Van Allen Plexico. Van Allen, tell us about yourself.
Hey, I'm Van Plexico. I'm a professor at Southwestern Illinois. And I am the author of 16 and counting novels in various fields, including some fantasy, some science fiction, military, superhero, pulp, all kind of stuff. And I also host the White Rocket Podcast, where I interview different writers and artists and editors and people and all kind of stuff. That's the tip of the iceberg, but that's all we really need to know.
Okay. All right. So Beowulf is one of our oldest stories in the English language, right? It is like the original Old English. It's written in English so old that it sounds like a foreign language to us, right? But it's not something that gets adapted into movies very often. And so what I'm curious about is whether it's because there's something about this story that doesn't adapt itself well to a visual medium. Does it have to be told to you? Or is it just that we haven't found the right way to do it yet? There's a couple adaptions of, there's been several adaptions of Beowulf. There was a TV series, and unfortunately I've not seen the TV series, but it was a BBC.
Bad.
Was it? I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. I was told when they created this track, oh, by the way, Beowulf belongs to you. I'm like, what Beowulf TV show? What are you talking about? So I have no opinion on it because I haven't seen it. But there was a BBC show that lasted for, I think, 2 seasons. Then there was the Zemeckis movie that came out about 10 years ago, which was an early experiment in mocap to varying levels of success. And then not a lot of people think about it this way, but The 13th Warrior, which is a very underrated movie, in my opinion. Yeah. Oh, you guys Michael agree with Craig. Me. This panel goes so much better if you guys all agree with me. but it is a pretty, like, the gritty reboot, kind of like, you know, the Batman Begins version of the Beowulf. So that's kind of what we're going to talk about. So let's start with the Zemeckis movie, because I think we can get that over pretty quickly. Van, what are your thoughts about have you seen that one?
Yeah.
Okay, what do you think?
Well, can we go actually back to the original for just a second and look at what it was trying to do, and then we can see maybe what these others are doing with it.
Yeah, let's do that. That sounds good.
Because the main reason I say that is because the original, and correct me if I'm wrong, mm-hmm. I mean, I know there's been a lot of criticism of it written, particularly by Tolkien. And by the way, the funny thing about J.R.R. Tolkien's criticism of Beowulf was not of Beowulf, it was of the critics of Beowulf, because he thought that they were paying way too much attention to the technical side of it and not really just enjoying it, which I think is kind of funny, but cool. And but it was kind of straightforward, right? I mean, it was just like, it was the hero story. Mm-hmm. It's one of the prototypical hero stories.
Yes.
Beowulf doesn't really have many flaws. He doesn't really learn or change or grow over the course of the story. The villains are pretty much the villains. I mean, you know, we understand modern storytelling to be about change and growth. You know, I'm a pulp writer, but even in pulp, while we're racing ahead at breakneck speed, things still need to change. If everything is the same at the end of the story as at the beginning, you haven't really told a story. So things need to change. And in Beowulf, really the only thing that changes is the monsters go from alive to dead, and Beowulf goes from younger to older, right, mm-hmm. and becomes a king. I mean, so the original story is a nice framework, okay? It's a nice framework of a hero's journey facing some monsters. It's got cool, like, setting and cool time and place and all that, cool monsters. But to really be a story that we in the modern world can appreciate, there has to be more to it. And so I would argue, and that's what I'm going to argue mm-hmm. for the next 45 minutes as we talk, is that these other interpretations of it are trying to find ways to present it in a more modern form. Even if they're not really maybe more or less trying to change the material, they're wanting to present the story in a way that it's not just bump, bump, bump. You know, that there's twists, there's surprises, there's changes to the status quo. Okay, so Zemeckis?
Uh-huh.
That was a really interesting take on it. I mean, I know that there's the superficiality, which is it is the first cousin of the Polar Express, right? And so everything that creeps you out about the Polar... See, this is funny. My wife has a tradition that my oldest daughter, they've always watched the Polar Express together every Christmas. And so I always find a reason to be very busy that night because there's only so much Tom Hanks with the dead eyes and the mustache that I can take. Now, give them credit. I mean, think about how far CGI and animation had to come just to get to that point. And then Beowulf is a little further beyond that. And I mean, the appeal of it is what Robert Zemeckis said to Neil Gaiman when Neil Gaiman was writing it, which was, I don't need all these conversations. It costs me the same amount of money to do a minute of conversation as a minute of mind-blowing action, unlike in a regular movie, right?
Yeah, yeah.
In a regular movie, the more people are talking, the cheaper the movie is, right? Mm-hmm. So that's why, like in that old Fantastic Four movie, the only special effect is the Human Torch catching fire for 2 seconds, because that's all they could afford, right? So they told him, look, you can just have crap blow up and dragons and stuff and all that. And so they actually went back and rewrote their script mm-hmm. to put more visual in it, because in CGI you can do whatever you can think of, right?
It's all there.
So that's all interesting. I mean, again, I understand its limitations, and I know you kind of look at it and go, it's kind of weird. But let's look for a second at the Neil Gaiman part of it, which I think is the worthwhile part. What Neil Gaiman brought to that movie was the and I guess there was a co-author, but I can't co-writer, but I can't remember. Was the idea that it was the human's fault, mm-hmm. right? That was something new, as far as I know. That, you know, first when you see Grendel, I mean, as soon as I'm watching that movie, and as soon as I see Grendel, I'm like, okay, he looks kind of human here. He looks kind of partly human. There's something going on here, and I'm already getting suspicious, right? And then, you know, you find out Angelina Jolie is the Grendel's mother monster, and you're like, okay, why would you have Angelina Jolie, this seductive woman, be the Grendel? Oh, right. So I like where, again, trying to bring it into the modern context, trying to have stuff happen that would have never happened necessarily in the old version. I give them credit for that. I thought it was very clever to have... It's really the human's fault. They get tempted by power. She's like the serpent with the apple, almost, you know. Oh, just come have sex with me. What could go wrong? You know, this will be great. I'm Angelina Jolie. Don't you recognize me? You know, and next thing you know, So yeah, I like the idea that it was that it all kind of went back to the humans being weak, almost like Lord of the Rings, where, you know, man is weak.
So the idea that there's like a flaw in someone, and that's why things happen. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How did it strike you? I mean,
so because of the CGI and the dead eyes, I've never been able to actually finish the movie. Like, it just, I can't. I've read recaps of the movie. I've read reviews of it, and like from that, I've kind of formed an opinion of it that it's if you can get past the creepy dead eye CGI-ness, right. It is actually a pretty good retelling of Beowulf, for the reasons that Van is saying, that it kind of updates the story more towards modern sensibilities and storytelling. It kind of condenses a few things, it kind of rearranges a few things, but in ways that are logical for the medium of film. So it's one of those things that if the technology was just a little bit further ahead, like if it was done using today's mocap, it would probably be a lot more commercially successful and a lot more critically successful, just because we wouldn't be like, well, what is that when we watch it? Because the script and the storytelling was pretty decent on it.
The crazy thing is it actually did make a decent amount of money, mm-hmm. relative to what you would expect.
Yeah.
And the critics at the time were impressed by a lot, mm-hmm. of it. It's just that we, you know, we see it in as it recedes into history, it looks worse. I think it just looks worse. I would suggest, yeah. watch it on your phone or something. Mm-hmm. Watch it on, like, Netflix on your phone. Yeah. It shrinks it down so small
that it's not as much
as on, yeah. your big TV.
Yeah, if I'm watching my big TV in the living, yeah. room, it's like, I can't.
Yeah, if you make those people real little, see.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not so.
You know, the original Star Trek,
mm-hmm.
TV series.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, the special effects, whatever, are just so limited there, mm-hmm. versus what we have now that it looks hokey.
I actually, yeah. have a thing about that. When I was a little kid watching the Star Trek reruns in the early 70s, mid-70s, they were on the local CBS channel in Birmingham, and our reception of that UHF channel was so bad that I had no idea the effects were bad. Years later, when I'm reading people criticizing the effects, I'm like, oh, they were bad?
Yeah. Not until, like, they started being shown on HD that I realized, like,
exactly.
wow, these are really bad.
Exactly.
Like, it's not just limited, but it's like, woo, you can see the string holding up the spaceship. Yeah.
Holding up William Shatner. Oh, wait, I'm sorry.
Right. From the audience, any thoughts about how Robert Zemeckis did with his adaption? Any big fans? Any big detractors? Sure.
I liked Ray Winstone in the role.
Okay.
I feel like he is sort of a paragon of that Cockney English masculinity, mm-hmm. and it's blending that old and that new. Beowulf is an English story. It's just old English, mm-hmm. and he is that ideal sort of warrior male, doesn't really progress, just goes from young to old, mm-hmm. archetype. Ray Winstone's a Cockney boxer before he was an actor.
Yeah.
You know, so I feel like 450 AD, ideal warrior male,
mm-hmm.
1990 Cockney, mm-hmm.
yeah, it
England.
Is, it's really ideal, good, yeah. a match of actor in the role.
Yeah, I felt he was one of the highlights. I feel like, mm-hmm. he did the role very well.
Honestly, I knew it was Ray Winstone. I knew that. But all the way through it, I just kept thinking that was Sean Bean. Because he kind of looked like Sean Bean. And I kept thinking, man, Beowulf's going to die. But also, you know that the way he looks, he doesn't look like Ray Winstone.
No, not at all.
And they said, because I think it was Zemeckis that said, we made him look like contemporary depictions of Jesus. Because they said that the way that artists depict Christ, mm-hmm. is this appealing across cultures, kind, mm-hmm. of this, the face, the hair. You know, if you think about it, he does look like Jesus has been working out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If he, like, went to the gym a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So the other Beowulf movie that gets talked about a lot is The 13th Warrior, which is based on Michael Crichton's novel, The Eaters of the Dead. So Michael Crichton wrote his own version of Beowulf, and then they came along later and made a movie version of it, which was directed by the same guy that did Die Hard. It's one of those things I always forget, but it makes a lot more sense once you realize that this is a Die Hard movie. So I mentioned earlier that I kind of consider it like the gritty reboot of Beowulf. They kind of strip out the mystical aspects of it. Instead of, yeah. monsters, it's cavemen.
But still monstrous.
But still monstrous and still not quite human. But just grounding it more in reality. So it's kind of like the Batman Begins of Beowulf retellings. This one is a movie that I like a lot. And I've rewatched it several times. Even getting ready for this panel, I watched it again. Yeah, because he's like, yeah, we need to do our homework, honey. What do you think about that movie? What do you think made it so successful?
That movie hovers around my top five movies of all time. Mm-hmm. Partly because my favorite thing in movies is the little band of people going on a job, whether that's 13th Warrior, Lord of the Rings, Ocean's 11. I don't care the time, the place. If there's a crew going on a job, I'm up for it. Okay. So the
I love watching people be competent.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's like, what.
Have you guys heard the term competency porn?
Yeah. I hadn't, but yes, yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, the Martian is is that, like, it's just watching this guy solve problems over and over again, and not Beowulf, but the 13th Warrior, like the way you're describing it, it is these very highly skilled people who are really good at what they do and know they're good at what they do, just solving problem after problem, like, okay, now we've done this, and now we're going to deal with this, and now we're going to deal with this, and just going down the line dealing with everything.
Turning a broadsword into a scimitar.
Yeah, just, and like they're like, this is how we do it.
It's funny you say that, because that's how Donald Westlake described why people like Parker, his master thief in those like 24 novels that I adore. He said that it's not, you know, they're like, do we like him because he's a criminal, because he kills people, whatever? Mm-hmm. Well, maybe, but we really like him because he's so good at what he does, and we like to see him execute the plan, and then when something goes wrong, he's a troubleshooter, he's a corrector. And, and so, yeah, there is a lot of that to the 13th War, Eaters of the Dead. So Eaters of the Dead. So Michael Crichton, you know, he never came up with a topic he couldn't write a novel about, and it was all over. I've been reading a lot of his books lately, and I just recently read Sphere and the Pirate Latitudes book that they're going to make a movie out of and everything, and he's all over the map. And with this one, I love the idea that he basically went back to the there was an Arab that traveled around a lot during that time and wrote a diary of his travels, and so you don't I didn't realize originally that that's the story this was. I didn't put together that Bouvai was Beowulf until later, and then I kind of went, oh, and the Vendel, stop saying it. And, you know, I'm like, oh, it kind of hit me later, right? But it's still, I thought it was fantastic. Now, there's so much to unpack about this, but yeah, so the book is Eaters of the Dead, which is... it's his diary and it's his account, and it's different from the movie. And it's, if you haven't read the book, it's totally worth reading because it's a totally different experience, but it's the same basic story. But for the movie, I think that, you know, so we looked at the Zemeckis movie and what was it trying to bring to that bare bones story?
Yeah.
So when we look at 13th Warrior, what is Crichton and company, what are they bringing to this story? And I think it's, you said right. One, they're getting rid of the mystical part of it. They're going to explain what's going on. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got, it's not a monster and the monster's mother. It's basically cannibal Neanderthals, right? Mm-hmm. And the Neanderthal mother. And so that's part of it. And then also, it's a shifting into a kind of a clash of cultures that you, again, don't get. Because in the original Beowulf, the only culture clash is this Viking tribe from here meets these strange, bizarre, foreign Viking people from right here. You know? And, oh, how will they ever... Whereas here you've got the Vikings and a guy from Arabia, which is totally alien. And one of the things I dearly love about that movie is that they kid each other, they kind of push him around a little bit when he's thrown in his lot with them at first and all that. But it's always in just kind of a, you know, good-natured, rough-housing, joshing way.
They're never bros.
But they're never mean to him. They're never mean-spirited to him. And that matters to me, because if they were bullies, I would not like that movie.
Yeah.
They kid him, they shove him around, but it's always just to test him, right?
But you also see them doing that with each other. Like, they're always trash-talking each other.
Oh,
so
yes.
So when they're including him in that, they're saying, you're part of our group, you know, you're different than us, whatever, but we're... You know, we're going to treat you like we treat everybody else, which is we're going to make fun of you.
And I think that that because of that, the most important character in that movie is Hergar, Joyous. Because he is the bridge, right, between them. The others are all just very dismissive of the Arab, Ibn, right?
Ibn.
They're dismissive of him, and they don't even want to give him a chance. And Herger is the one that first translates and then kind of starts, because he's interacting with him more, starts to see his value, you know, starts to see, well, he can contribute something. It's not just because the witch doctor lady said we need to take the black, you know, bone along with the 12 white bones. It's that he really has things that he can contribute. Can he swing a giant sword? No, but he gets around that. As you said, he fixes his sword. You know, does he... And plus, he thinks that he is totally from a superior culture, right? He thinks that his people know. And honestly, in that day and age, the Islamic realm was way ahead of everybody else. Yeah. And so they did know a lot of stuff, but he doesn't know to put cow pee on his wound, right? He thinks he does. Don't put the filth on me. Put water. She's like, I can put water on you, and you're going to have a giant infection and pus and all this. And he's like, put the cow pee. So he learns, right? He realizes I'm not the only one that knows stuff. These Vikings have very important skills too. So there's this really interesting cross-cultural mimesis going on here where there's stuff being learned from one to the other, and that's really cool. Even when they're reluctant, you know, even when they're reluctant. So that's really awesome. And then, so you got the cultural thing, you've got the making it more realistic thing in a way.
Well, and I also like, I bumped my thing. Okay, so I also like that there's, that Crichton added another character to the story. So in addition to Beowulf and the monsters and whatever, but he added a point of view character for the audience. And so someone who is witnessing all these great deeds and is going to be recording them later.
Yes.
Eben is the audience surrogate. He's the one that is having everything explained to him so that we are getting it explained to us. He's the one who, you know, is like, what's going on around here? Because we're, as the audience, reacting in that way. And so it's really nice. It's a storytelling trope, but it's a storytelling trope that works because it lets you kind of insert yourself into this world. So a lot of Eben's preconceptions about their culture are the same as ours, you know, et cetera. And so you can just kind of like follow his journey through everything, and you learn along with him, and you grow along with him as the audience.
Yeah, it's neat because they introduce it slowly. At first, everything the Vikings do is gross and horrible and violent and bloody and terrible.
Yeah.
From chopping off your brother's head during dinner or whatever, to blowing your nose in the bowl and then handing it to the next guy to wash his face in, and they're just like, oh, thanks. Oh, seasoning, great. You know, I'm good. And he's like,
gross.
But as it goes along, though, he starts seeing things that they do that are helpful and that are better than what he. And I think that's really cool. And there was another one I mentioned. But anyway, yeah, it's very cleverly constructed in that way, and it's remarkable. And we can get into this, but it's also remarkable that it's so effective in that way because there were so many troubles and issues surrounding this movie. And we can
before we
get out of this movie, I want to talk a little bit about how challenges.
Yeah, I said that it was John McTiernan who's credited as the director. He's credited as the director, but he didn't direct a lot of it.
Right.
So
Crichton came along. I guess he must have had a really good contract with the production company because Crichton looked at it and said, okay, A, we're going to completely redo the ending, and B, even though Graham Revel did the score, I don't like it, throw it away, we're going to do a whole new score, and by the way, yay, because the Goldsmith, Jerry Goldsmith, right?
It's excellent.
Fantastic. In fact, the Jerry Goldsmith score is so great that they stole parts of it for Kingdom of Heaven, which, by the way, is another awesome movie if you see the director's long cut, right? But you'd be watching Kingdom of Heaven, and they're like, dun, 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 dun. And you're like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. Where's the Vikings, you know, coming out? They're going to help Jerusalem. But, so he came in and said, we're going to redo the score, and we're going to redo the whole ending, and they refilmed it. And I feel like there's an even longer director's cut out there somewhere, or I guess executive producer's cut.
Yeah.
Screenwriter's cut. That I'd love to see, but I think we're probably never going to see it because it wasn't a hit. In fact, it's probably his worst performing movie.
Yeah, and it's
Banderas's.
Yeah, it's definitely it was not commercially successful. Honey, when you went to go see it, how many people were in the audience with you?
At least two.
Yeah.
I remember.
Yeah. The day we met, he went to the movies by himself because we weren't actually officially dating yet. And so he went with a friend.
I mean, that's why I said the least.
Yeah, so he went with a friend of his to go watch that movie and then told me about it the next day. But yeah, it was very, very lightly attended, that movie theater.
Yeah, I went to it with my girlfriend at the time when it opened. and it wasn't very big. And it, and what's so crazy is because we came out of it, and I'm like, I think that's one of my favorite movies I've ever seen. And she's like, really? I'm like, yeah. You know, in a year of The Phantom Menace, but, you know, and The Matrix and all that, 99.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of other really good or high-profile movies that came out that year that were genre-related, and so kind of sucked up a lot of the oxygen in that way. But this was also pre-internet, but pre-internet being a big thing.
Social media.
Social media, and so it didn't get a lot of buzz. We didn't have Rotten Tomatoes back then to aggregate all the reviews, and it looked kind of weird and kind of silly in the way they promoted it. You know, being a huge nerd, of course, I went to go see it, but, you know, I was the only one.
I've gone back and looked at what some people were saying, I just archived here and there, about it when it was getting ready to come out, and the people that were really buzzing about it, believe it or not, before it came out, well, I guess it makes sense, were the Antonio Banderas, like, hardcore fans.
Yeah.
And I wonder if maybe they didn't like it because he wasn't the tough action hero in it. He was kind of almost like an effeminate, you know, he has to learn to be a hero. So maybe they were disappointed because he wasn't like Zorro or something.
Yeah. But, you know. I mean, that makes a lot of sense because his fan base at that time was really based off of the action movies he was doing with
Desperado.
Yeah. Thank you. So, yeah, it's a very different role from that, but it's a good role for him.
It always made me sad, too, that a number of those Scandinavian actors actually came back to the United States with him after they made that movie, hoping to break into Hollywood when this was a big hit.
Yeah, no, we've never heard from any of these people again. Yeah.
Well, the only one is Vladimir Kulich that played Bulvi because he did appear in the first season of Vikings.
Okay.
And he gets... But it was so good to see him, you know, because you're watching the younger characters and everything, and all of a sudden Vladimir Kulich walks out, and you're like, oh, now we got Vikings. Yeah. Now we got some Vikings out there, because they're the man, right?
He did a movie with James Purefoy called Ironclad.
Oh, he's in that?
A Templar is, like, holding out in a castle against these Viking mercenaries that King John, the younger brother of King Richard, hires, and he's the leader of the Vikings.
So it's a spinoff of Robin Hood, basically.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Dude, I'm in now. I've heard of that movie.
Dude, it is. Paul Giamatti plays King John.
Oh,
it's his most underrated performance.
I can see that.
Wild.
John the Stupid. He's John the Stupid. Right.
Yeah.
I'm in. I'm gonna have to watch this.
Wild.
I remember from the American Four was Tony Curran. He did bit parts in like The Gladiator, and then he was one of the main characters in the sci-fi show Defiance.
Was he one of the Vikings?
Yes, he was the redhead.
The redheaded one.
He was
also
the Invisible Man in League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, but you wouldn't know.
Okay. But he was invisible.
I'm a big fan of Tony Curran.
Yeah, he was very good in that. Yeah, they had a great cast. I mean, all the Vikings were good in it. You just don't get to see a whole lot of each of them very much, other than Hurger and Bulvi. But I thought they were all different, right? Uh-huh. They each brought a little different. Yeah. One's an archer, you know, and
well, and they all had a distinctive look to them when they were cast and in their costuming, and they also had distinctive skill sets, like you said. And so even if you didn't learn their names, you kind of knew like, oh, that's the archer guy. Oh, that's the guy that sits up in the trees. Like you kind of figure that part out. And they seem to have distinctive personalities. They handled having such a large cast very well, which is a really difficult thing to do. One of the big criticisms of the Hobbit movies is that you can't tell any of the dwarves apart from each other because they just didn't juggle that large of a cast very well. They all look sort of similar to each other. It doesn't work as
except
well.
Except for Poldark.
Yeah, you can't
tell him.
Yeah. But that's because juggling a very large cast of characters like that is incredibly difficult to do.
And the other thing about that movie that always jumps out at me is, is it just me or does it seem like the beginning should have been like 20 minutes long? And I feel like Crichton went there and said, let's get them to the Vikings, just chop, chop, chop. Because you get like a... It's like 2 minutes.
Like
you know?
A little, there's like a 2 minute prologue thing.
I was here with the Sultan, and I looked at his wife wrong, and he sent me over here. Mm-hmm. And Omar Sharif and I did this, and there were some Mongols. Oh, forget them. There's the Vikings, and then boom, and it's like whoa, that like.
See, I would actually cut all of
months,
that out.
Months went by.
Yeah, like it's almost like it's too much story at that point. It's like slows you down getting into the plot of the movie. Like I would rather start with them riding up to the Viking camp and seeing what's going on there, and just kind of leave everything else out.
Or actually have it as story, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, go one way or the other. It's like they tried to have it as part of the story, but yet cram it at you real fast.
It's the way it's structured right now, it's too little.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have any impact on anything further down the line. Like, we don't need to know everything about Eben and how he got there. We don't need to see, like, the previous hour before he rides into the Viking camp. We just need to know that he has been exiled and he's run into these Vikings.
Bless Omar Sharif's heart. Mm-hmm. Why is he even in the movie?
Well, because they paid him.
Well, it's like if Gandalf showed up at Frodo's house at the beginning of Fellowship of the Ring and you never see him again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
well, have fun in Mordor. I got to go over here.
I think I remember reading somewhere that was Omar Sharif's final role, because after that he was just so disgusted with making movies. Yeah. He's like, why was I even on this set?
Mm-hmm.
And just quit taking roles after that.
Same thing with Sean Connery.
Like, why did I do this?
You know this.
Because it's actually a really good movie. I agree.
This is now a league panel.
Do you know why Sean Connery was, well?
This is a good story.
He was asked to be Gandalf in Lord of the Rings, and he's like, no, I'm going to go do this League of Extraordinary Gentlemen movie that's going to make way more money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he didn't understand the script of Lord of the Rings, because he's like, what is this about elves and
crap? He didn't know who to shoot or sleep with.
Yeah. It's Sean Connery, so I understand. So he didn't understand the script, and so he took League of Extraordinary Gentlemen again, because he's like, next time I see a movie I don't understand, I'm going to take it, because I could have made all this money off Lord of the Rings. Because they offered him an incredibly lucrative contract. They offered him a percentage of the profits of the movie. And of course nobody knew it was going to make money at the time, so it was a really easy deal for New Line to make, but he could have been a bazillionaire if he'd taken it.
I think it worked out for the best, though.
I can't imagine Sean Connery is playing Gandalf.
It's not like Sean doesn't have
money. Yeah. I'm sure he's fine.
It's a League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Okay, any other thoughts about 13th Warrior?
It's just so good. It's so underrated.
So good.
It's
so good.
My favorite part about that movie is,
into the microphone.
Use the microphone. My favorite part about that movie is because, you know, the story of Beowulf, he did all these extraordinary things, and it's kind of like the story of King Arthur, where, you know, we don't know where the story originated from, we don't know who Arthur really is, we just know by these stories. And so it felt to me for the 13th War was like a D&D adventure, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You had all these different people who, it makes more sense that all these outstanding things were accomplished by multiple people, and an Arab walks into a Viking camp and they had an adventure. Whoa, write it down.
Uh-huh.
The other thing is the ending, I guess. We didn't talk about that Crichton really changed the ending. I really wonder how the original ending must have gone. I don't remember how the book ending goes, but I imagine that it involves them. Remember the Vendel, stop saying it. Every time I say it, but they come back. Remember, they make their mm-hmm. one last sort
yes.
of fury charge at mm-hmm. the camp, at the city. And it's the guy with the horns, and they kill him, and then they go away, and they're like, well, I guess we have to go be extinct now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they go off and die, basically.
Yeah.
But was that, I mean, did it end before with, like, them coming back from the cave, and Beowulf of Bulvi dies, and it's just like, and well, that's it. I mean, I wonder what the ending was without that attack.
Because I haven't seen anything saying what it was. There's no deleted extras on a DVD anywhere.
That's why I want a director's Blu-ray or something.
Because that's something I'm curious about as well.
I'd like to have the alternate score, even though I like this one better.
It's a good score.
I'd like to have the missing scenes. There's so much about it that I wonder about. Oh, and that was, and the reason, you know, if we said it came out in 99, it sat on the shelf for like 2 years because they didn't want to release it. They weren't even they were never comfortable with it, the studio. They finally just said, let's just put it out there, and it had no fanfare.
Dropped it in like late August, which is like when you drop movies you're fail.
It was the same kind of thing as John Carter. It's a thing where the studio doesn't understand it. And they just they're like, well, we've spent this much money on it, let's just throw it out there, we're not going
to
advertise it,
release it.
Yeah. And then and it has a cult following.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So, any thoughts from the audience about 13th Warrior that we haven't shared yet? Anybody?
I don't want to forget the crowd over here. We're in panel.
All right. Moving along. Okay. So, if we were to make our own Beowulf movie, what would that movie look like? Like, what would our ideal not 13th Warrior retelling of Beowulf be?
Right here.
Okay. Jimmy, go grab some people for me.
Hi. I actually was a film studies major while studying Beowulf in college, so I thought a lot about this.
Okay.
I'm not sure for the overall film, but there's a lot of parts of Beowulf, like specific scenes, where before cameras ever existed, they have a camera pan in there, mm-hmm. where they move from above to through cold water to the depths. And I just really want someone who is an actual, like, old English style Beowulf scholar who, like, pays attention to the words other than just the story to go through and, for a cinematic adaptation, adapt both the literature and the story of trying to take some inspiration from those scenes where it's like, oh, they tell you a part where he is, like, slashed bloody red. Like, this is a pretty good time to cut to that wound, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Or to, like, have... It's a work that, if you pay a lot of attention to camera work and editing, which is my favorite thing, it gives you a lot of stuff to work with. I wish that I had written down examples, but that's my thought about that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think there's a lot of Beowulf that's very cinematic.
So, have y'all ever seen Valhalla Rising?
No.
Not the best movie.
Okay.
But it's really interesting and gritty, and there's almost no dialogue in it.
Okay.
So I think that a decent retelling of the story would be in that vein, where it's stripped down to its basic elements, there's very little dialogue, and it's essentially, because the story is a lot of genealogy, a lot of history as well, and basically just tell the part where it's like scene opening, watchmen on the shores, the ship arrives.
Mm-hmm.
Barely any dialogue at all. Almost similar to Apocalypto too, where there's like it's all in Old English or Old Danish, and just keeping to its basic elements of the story of the hero arriving. There's a crisis and he fixes it, and there's almost no explanation, and it's just really just simple. And this is the story. I think that would work, especially to keep it relatively historically accurate and just crank up the grittiness because you know. Mm-hmm. Game of Thrones is out, so.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that's one of the impacts of Game of Thrones on our culture right now, and with fantasy, is trying to make it as gritty and realistic as possible, but not everything has to be naked.
Actually, I had the same thought. I was like, Mel Gibson's Apocalypto.
Mm-hmm.
Tribal element there, minimalist story, native actors... Like, get Scandinavian actors, mm-hmm. shoot it in Denmark, put it in Old English.
Okay.
And you're halfway there. You are halfway there to a fantastic Beowulf movie, entirely in Old English. Like, I mean, they kind of did that with Beowulf and Grendel.
Uh-huh.
Visually, Beowulf and Grendel with Gerard Butler is pretty good visually.
Okay.
As far as historical accuracies and things like that. Mm-hmm. But shoot on location, get native Scandinavian actors, put it in Old English, and you're half, that's half the battle.
Okay.
This is more a question to y'all. I'd just like to see what people think about this, because you got one adaptation where the mother is definitely still monstrous, in very much the same vein as Grendel, but then the other one, of course, with Angelina Jolie, she's the seductress kind of monster, which for the sake of variety and plot makes it logical sense to make that change. But if you're trying to capture the genuine spirit of Beowulf, is that a change that is detrimental to doing that, or is it something that you can keep if you do it differently, or anything along those lines?
Don't show the monster.
What?
Don't show the monster.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe an arm, maybe a hand. Don't show it.
Yeah.
Let the audience do it.
Like, one of the thoughts I had about like how would I do an adaptation of Beowulf is I would like Sam Raimi to do it. Because there's a lot of elements to it that feel like a horror movie to me or a horror novel. And so I love Sam Raimi's horror work. I think it's just, I just think it would be a really good marriage of a director and material if he did that.
What about a...
Bruce
Campbell.
Bruce Campbell would play Grendel's mother, obviously.
I was going to say, what about Guillermo del Toro?
That's another one. Like, but I think you definitely want like a horror person directing this. And that would give you that like you tease the monster rather than showing it straight up.
You know, that was my argument for back in the late 90s for why I wanted Peter Jackson to do Lord of the Rings was because he was at that time a horror director.
Yes.
And he's going to bring a visceralness to this that like Chris Columbus doing Harry Potter would not have would not have brought. Right. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's a good point. Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if this will be popular in this panel, but I don't know why people want to adapt Beowulf in this way. Like, so I'm a huge fan of Beowulf the poem, but like it's not about any of these things. And people who actually like the poem for itself, like it's more about the speeches. It's
the language.
And the way that the political interactions happen, I mean, like, that's the stuff that makes the story interesting. And if it's just a monster story, let's go to Gilgamesh.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it has more, right? It has more about people. I don't know why Beowulf adaptations, why are people wanting that so badly?
Yeah. No, I think you make a really good point that there's something in our culture that skews towards you're not really an important story unless someone's made a movie out of you. Like, we're doing a panel tomorrow about adapting high fantasy stories because there's like something like 12 different high fantasy book series that are going to get adapted into a movie or TV series at some point. And everybody gets really excited when that gets announced because, yes, finally our story has arrived and now it's legitimate and now people will pay attention to it. And like, it doesn't become part of pop culture and the zeitgeist until it becomes on a big screen or a streaming service near you.
It's true.
Like, until very recently, the best-selling non-Tolkien fantasy series was The Wheel of Time. But because of the HBO series, Game of Thrones is now the best-selling fantasy series because more people recognize the name now because it's on HBO. And I'm not going to make any judgments as to the quality of either one because I like both. There was a reason why Wheel of Time was a best-selling series for so long compared to Game of Thrones. I mean, they're both bestsellers, but it was selling more. But just the overriding nature of our culture is that it's got to be on a screen, otherwise people don't think it's important. So I think you make a very good point that that's not necessarily serving the story well to adapt it into a format it was not meant to be in, or that like the author or whoever came up with Beowulf could not even have conceived of that. But for some reason, we just want it to happen, and like it just doesn't make sense sometimes.
Do you think the opposite is also true? Like that we can't just enjoy an awesome Viking movie story about battles and whatever if it doesn't have the name Beowulf, right? If it wasn't...
Well, we've got Vikings, so we do have an awesome Viking story.
Yeah, but why? I guess everything is an adaptation. It's like the reverse of what you're saying, too. Like, it has to be both.
Yeah, and that's the other thing that's kind of skewed in our culture right now is... The top grossing movies right now are not original movies. They're sequels and they're adaptations.
That's right.
Because it's very difficult to get anything made in Hollywood without some kind of name recognition behind it. So if you're not already famous, you better be attached to something famous.
Arguably, Hollywood's always had that problem.
Oh, yeah. It's just worse now than it was a few decades ago. Like, I think
we have sequels thrown on top of the
The accountants, the insurance agents have taken over Hollywood, and it's more about commerce than art these days, which is not really a new thing. Like, you know, let's face it, we're not making movies out of charity, but it's definitely like way more obvious now than it was before.
Well, one of the difficult things for a filmmaker to do too is to take a written work and translate it into a visual work. Some things do very, very well with that, but there are some written works that are very difficult
absolutely
to put into a visual format.
Well, and just the needs of a film adaptation, like looking at movies, you guys know about the 60-minute explosion mark? Like, does anybody know this one? Of course you do. All right, so when you're watching a movie, you can set your watch to it. If it's a good action movie, something will explode at exactly 60 minutes in the movie, or something very, very important happens at that moment. Like in A New Hope, the 60-minute moment is when Luke gets onto the Death Star. In Independence Day, it's when they blow up the White House. Like, you could set your watch by it. Titanic kind of gets away with stretching out the movie because they reset the clock when the flashback starts. And so the 60-minute explosion is the iceberg hits the boat exactly 60 minutes after the flashback starts, when Rose starts telling her story. So anytime you're watching a movie and you're like, oh man, this movie is like really slow, I'm kind of bored right now, it's because the 60-minute explosion is late. And so there's other marks like that in a movie where it has to happen at this point, otherwise we don't know if it's because the audience is trained to expect it to happen, or if there's just something about like the way stories are told that you get bored if something doesn't blow up 60 minutes into it.
I'll bet that in 13th Warrior, it's the moment that, I don't know, but I'll bet it's the first time the Vendel attack the town after they get there and they're pretending to sleep or whatever. Mm-hmm. I bet
that's the right point. Yeah, like once you know about this, you'll start watching movies with a stopwatch.
Like mentally at least.
I drove my husband crazy because I learned about this off of a podcast. And so for like 2 weeks afterwards, anytime we watched a movie at home, I'm like, and now it's 60 minutes in. Let's see what happens. He's like, oh my God, shut up. but yeah, so what would be the 60-minute explosion of Beowulf? What happens 60 minutes in? Like something's got to explode at that point, or someone's got to die or get stabbed. Like, I don't know. I don't know how that works. The arm coming off, that'd be a good one for the 60 minute. Yeah. Okay. There was some comments over here.
Yeah. I was just going back with the movie adaptations. I actually think the like Zemeckis one with Neil Gaiman writing it, like, that's the only thing I've ever read that, or like seen that I did not like what Neil Gaiman wrote.
Mm-hmm.
Because like the whole point of Beowulf is the very basic hero story that's all about like the lineages and the different kings and all that sort of thing, how it all relates. And so I think like a really good way to do the movie is just try to be as true to form as possible. Like you're talking about doing it in the language with the right actors and that kind of thing. But also like you still try to do some of the speeches, and then you're talking about the 60-minute thing. I'm thinking maybe, I don't know, it'd be hard because it's kind of like three separate acts with three different
characters. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just modern movies are not structured that way anymore.
Yeah, so it would kind of have to be in almost a different format than a normal movie, but I would really also like to see it filmed in the same way, like kind of like the Revenant, where you have that gritty, but you also have those long panning shots and some of the nature shots and that sort of thing.
That would be beautiful. Well, maybe Iñárritu needs to take a crack at it. Yeah. That's a director we hadn't talked about.
Yeah.
But he would be an interesting choice.
That would be a good one. Iñárritu, he directed... what's the movie where Leonardo DiCaprio gets eaten by a bear?
The Revenant.
Yeah, The Revenant. Revenant, yeah.
Yeah, it is a gorgeous... Good gosh. I came out of the theater like... It was like... It wasn't cold outside when I saw that movie, and I was wanting a blanket when I came out. It's just the whole movie is... So the cinematography is just gorgeous, yeah. That would be a good choice.
Hey, what's up?
Hey. This is more just an observation. I've seen several Beowulf adaptations, most of them really terrible, like, C-grade movies. But I have noticed, and like you said before, Beowulf is kind of a three-part story. He goes, he fights and kills Grendel, then he goes and fights and kills his mom. Then we have a big time skip, and he's a king, and he fights and kills a dragon. And other than the mocap movie, like, none of them do him as a king and kill the dragon. They let him kill Grendel and then kill the mom right back to it, and the third part's just not there.
Yeah, they did tip their hat to the dragon in 13th Warrior by saying that it was the people carrying the torches down the hill looked like the Fire of Them. I saw the Fire of Them, though.
And Bolvine was a king. He just wasn't in his kingdom. He never made it to his kingdom.
He went somewhere else, like this, like the Justice League.
Mostly, like I said, the C-grade movies.
Yeah.
Even in the loose adaptations. Like I said, Grendel's mom, no dragon. Mm-hmm.
You know, one other thing when we're talking about the Zemeckis movie that I thought was really cool was I love how at the beginning they play up the whole idea, and that's what John Malkovich's character was for.
Mm-hmm.
They play up the whole idea that nobody believes he actually has done these things. He shows up to save the day, And they're like, oh, yeah, right. So what's your resume? And he's like, well, I did this, I did this. And they're like, oh, uh-huh, you did that, right? And Malkovich is totally like, oh, yeah, you did that. It's the perfect actor to play that, right? He's just like, oh, you did that, did you? Oh, sure you did, you know. And so it kind of gives him another hurdle to have to jump. That he has to actually prove he can do all these superhuman, you know. It's almost like like he's saying, well, I killed 12 whatever. And he's like, are you sure it wasn't like 20, you know? And he's like, no, it was 12, you know. So, you know.
Something this gentleman over here brought up, the idea that in addition to the fact that it's a story in thirds instead of a half, you know, in halves, it is also the fact that it's a hero who is just a hero. He's not flawed in the sense that he's you know, has some tragic sin trailing after him or anything. He's just a hero. And a lot of modern, and I think maybe a lot of adaptations also get tripped up with trying to make him a modern hero by giving him those flaws and being afraid. Just make a hero a hero. I remember when Deathly Hallows came out, and one of the reviews said, well, the book doesn't live up to expectations because the heroes just win. It's okay. I think critics and people who write stories for a living maybe sometimes overestimate our need for complexity. Sometimes we just want a hero.
Yeah.
And I think Beowulf really is one of those people why he stood the test. Sometimes we just want a hero and he's great at it.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe an adaptation that doesn't try to make him anything more than just a hero might be more successful.
I do think that's why we want adaptations, is because we do want that hero.
I can just project this.
Talking back to both of you folks about both it ending at the mother of the dragon and about Beowulf not being just a hero who wins, I think that both of those versions kind of miss out on the Vikingness of Weird and Neith, of the world wants you dead and it will win, and of the cycle of perpetual violence. I think that what makes it interesting to me is a lot of the time, hey, this hero did all these great things, but if you try and stab a dragon in the skull when you're an old man, you will die. There is nothing, like, it might be more satisfying if the old king can be victorious once again and walk away. No, you die from that. You will one day die. This is a real depressing thing for Comic-Con. But also the sense of that, like, neither of those things, again, are really uplifting in the way that American culture tends to like, rather than like old middle of the winter Viking culture,
mm-hmm.
of just darkness and violence and like the end of the world is coming. That was upbeat.
Part of it, I think, is with our modern heroes, we want them to be flawed. The flaw in the poem is not in Beowulf. It's in the society. It's in Hrothgar's society that can't mm-hmm. save itself. It's in Beowulf's society with his thanes desert him, and he has to attack the dragon himself, and he dies, and then the gates die off. That's the reason society ends, and I think that's kind of what's missing in the adaptations, because mm-hmm. we want to see the hero. Mm-hmm. We don't want to see the impact mm-hmm. that it has, and that poem's a lot about the impact of Beowulf's life and what was going on in the history of it.
When you're talking about ancient civilizations, the hero always died. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. That's what we've come to expect. Mm-hmm.
The Iliad, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Iliad, Gilgamesh, yeah.
Odysseus did survive.
So he did, but it was like one.
He's totally different.
What if he took a kind of a Princess Bride approach? And he places the whole story, those events, within the context of the way this would originally been presented, which would be likely a bard. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was their recording of their history and their culture and how the next generation was educated and passing on the knowledge. And so kind of use that as a framing piece around to kind of give a reaction, how the people were reacting to hearing these stories. So you're getting two points mm-hmm. of view. You're getting, you know, focusing in on what happened in the story, and then also, you know, the little boy saying, you know, well,
what happens next, Grandpa? Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
No kissing, you know, all that.
Cool. Yeah, no, that would be very cool. Like, have it be like, you know, a little storyteller sitting around a fire and then throw the thing in the fire. Yeah.
You could even use some of the original poetry. Mm-hmm. Have a person speaking in the Old English to, like, pull you into
the mm-hmm. scene he's the opposite about.
Start and regular yeah no that'd be very cool
right
my teacher did when I did Canterbury Tales to get us used to mm-hmm. middle English.
Oh okay
start it and then mm-hmm. transition we didn't notice the difference
mm-hmm. Okay.
So kind of to the earlier person's point, they're asking why do we keep coming back to Beowulf when it, some other folks' point is true, it doesn't really translate well to film. I think part of it is it's English. It's the first English epic, even though technically it's Danish. And it's, we're an Anglo-centric culture because that's kind of where America was founded. And I think that's part of the reason everyone knows the name and keeps coming back to it. But fundamentally, it's a history. It's a genealogy. It says, who are we? Where did we come from? Who are our enemies? Our enemies are the Swedes over here. Our enemies are here. You know, we're helping our friends, the Geats or Geats, but we are the Danes. And it's told by Danes in England to reaffirm who they are in their place because they've invaded England and now they're getting anglicized a bit. So I think it's a good story, but if we really wanted to tell a good Viking story, we should look probably towards later to the Icelandic prose sagas. They're told about people who are asking questions of who are we, but what is our government? What is our society? What are we trying to figure this out? Because at the time when they're trying to figure out their government, eventually they decide to become a part of the Kingdom of Norway. But there's a ton of them. And there's a couple movie adaptations, like there's one from the 80s called like the Saga of Gisli, where mm-hmm. he becomes an outlaw because he kills somebody and has to go on the run. And then he has some family and friends that help him. But it's very human-centric about the flaws of people that you just don't get in Beowulf. Because Beowulf has to be an archetypal story. It has to be a story about a hero and the hero's journey. Which just, if it's done poorly, it doesn't do so well, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where it's good. But if we want that Viking flavor, there's so many other better things out there we can choose.
Okay. All right, so we're running short on time. Okay, so we'll do one more question from the audience, then we'll start wrapping things up.
I just wanted to let you know, this has been a great panel so far.
Oh, thank
you. It's been awesome. It's the first panel of the con for me, so it's been a really good time. I'll keep this short. Going sort of backtracking to the idea of if we had to do a screen adaptation of Beowulf, and I agree, we don't have to do a screen adaptation of Beowulf. If they never do another one again, I'd be perfectly okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
But to kind of put him in the modern hero context and make him flawed. I'm a little bit of a scholar of Old English and Anglo-Saxon poetry. The idea of the flawed hero was not unknown to the Anglo-Saxon people. I'll give you an example. There's another poem that was finally written down around the time of Beowulf. Beowulf was told by the skalds and the bards and Mead Halls much later, but there was an instance where Anglo-Saxons fought Vikings in 991, and the poem's called The Battle of Maldon.
Yeah!
And Maldon, there's an Anglo-Saxon earl, a jarl, named mm-hmm. Brittonoth, and he has to fight off these Viking invaders. And he fails, spoiler, he dies at the end of the poem, because the poem describes he has ubermut, overpride. He's too heroic.
Okay.
His heroics get him, and not only him, but his whole retinue of bodyguards killed. And it's sort of a tragic, it's sort of an idea of, the poem has a duality to it. Be heroic, defend your homeland. Oh, he was over-heroic. He was too prideful, mm-hmm. and he dies tragically a warrior's death.
Okay.
I get that hubris.
Yeah. Hubris.
It's a big thing in ancient literature.
Yeah. Don't be too awesome.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So, Van, any final thoughts for us?
No, I think it's just that we love the hero's tale, and it's just mm-hmm. always going to be a challenge to find a way, particularly when you're dealing with Hollywood. It's just they're going to always look for... Hollywood is not going to say, we need to make this story where nothing changes and there's a lot of speeches. They're going to say, how can we make this into something that will be appealing to a mass audience? And like it or not, they're always going to approach it that way. And it's just a good backbone, and it's like you say, it's one that people have heard of. It's a known brand. So as long as it's a known brand and it's a good backbone for whatever, it's like a black and white picture that you can color however you want to color it,
yeah.
It's going to keep getting done whether we like it or not.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that kind of wraps it up. Okay, so thank you for coming to our panel. Let me pull up.
Great contribution, great stuff.
Yeah.
All right, and that was the panel. I appreciate everybody who came out, and I appreciate Jennifer for inviting me to be on it. It was a lot of fun. Once again, I want to thank our patrons who keep us on the air. And if you would like to join the family and help us to produce more shows like this, just go to www.plexico.net, P-L-E-X-I-C-O.net, www.plexico.net, and there you will find links to everything as well as to the Patreon page where you can help us out and join up and reap all the benefits of membership. So the Rocket's going to get on out of here for another episode, and we'll see you guys down the road.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.